evening to you. I'm Tom Lounges, and for the next hour, we'll be spending time together here on the dial at 89.1 FM, The Lakeshore. Tonight on Midwest Beats, my musical guest is British guitarist Martin Barr. Martin returns tonight for what is his second appearance on Midwest Beat this year, and once again, we'll be sharing memories of his 43-plus years as the lead guitarist of Jethro Tull and of being a frequent guest on albums by some of music's biggest stars. Martin Barr and his band will perform this Friday at Reggie's Rock Club in Chicago. Showtime 7:30. We'll give you details on the show. We'll talk to Martin and we'll play songs off his latest album, Back to Steel, and maybe a few classics as well. It's all coming up on the other side of your headlines right here. Good evening to you. I'm Tom Lounges, and tonight on Midwest Beats, we've got a very special guest joining us by phone, British guitarist Martin Barr, formerly of Jethro Tull. Tonight marks the second appearance of Martin Barr on Midwest Beat this year, and we're happy to have him back. He's coming back to Chicago. He'll be performing at Reggie's Nightclub in Chicagoland. We've got a new album to present, Back to Steel, and we're going to feature songs from it. We're also going to talk to Martin about his 43 years as the lead guitar player with Jethro Tull, and also his frequent guest appearances on albums by some of music's biggest stars, like Phil Collins, Gary Moore, and even Paul McCartney. During his career, Martin has performed gigs with the likes of Jimi Hendrix, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Fleetwood Mac, and just about every band that was anybody during the 1960s. Most recently, Martin's been touring the world with his own band, and we're going to talk about that as well. The Martin Barr Band, coming to Reggie's Rock Club in Chicago, and you can find that club at 2109 South State Street in Chicago. We'll be featuring Martin on the air in just a few minutes, but first, let's let the music do the talking by giving you something new off the Back to Steel album. This is Bad Man.
I'm a bad man, not a good guy. Some situations I could have kissed my ass goodbye. I'm a fall guy, not a tall guy. When I hit the dust, I hit it hard. Adieu. You know I'm a bad man, I'm a gray guy. My hair is long and it's a badge of protest. It was only girls that ever brought me joy. Just a backpack, no money in my sack. A road to follow, no looking back. So farewell now, don't you cry. You'll see me in your dream time. Good guy.
is a bad man, but a great guitar player. He is Martin Barr, and he's with us right now. That's brand new stuff off the album Back to Steel, an album that's bringing him back here to Midwest Beat for a guest appearance, and he's also coming back to Reggie's Rock Club in Chicago. That show is Friday, this Friday, 7:30 p.m. Reggie's is at 2109 South State Street in Chicago. Martin Barr, are you with us?
Hi, Tom. Yes, I'm here.
Good to have you back. It's been a few months since you were here. You were performing at Martyrs last time in Chicago, and now you're coming back to Reggie's.
Yeah, well, you know, I love Chicago so much that I'm just happy to be anywhere in the city. So we're really looking forward to coming back.
Now, this is the second leg of the U.S. tour. Did you go and play overseas back in the U.K. While you were gone from us?
I can't remember what happened. We did a few festivals, but basically we did a spring tour of the US, and then back in the UK we had a few festivals in Europe and the UK. We had a few little trips to Spain and Italy, but not as a tour, just sort of odd weekends. And then now we've been back in the States for 6 weeks, and we've got another month and a bit to go, so that's great.
All right. Well, we're happy to have you back in Chicago, and I'm certainly glad to have you back on the show, and we'll try to touch on some new stuff this time around. And the album is Back to Steel. It came out, I want to say, about a year ago now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, last November.
Uh-huh. Now, yeah. This album, compared to some of your earlier stuff, a lot of your earlier solo albums were more instrumental-based. This one has you singing an awful lot on it. Was that a direct change for a reason?
Now I'm not singing on it. That's Dan. Crystal, so I could sing.
Okay.
I had a voice like Dan Crisp, I'd be in heaven. it was important to start writing for a band and recording and playing as a band. So, I mean, it's sort of described as a solo album, but essentially the all four of the band are playing, including me, are playing on all of the album. And we've started doing tours. I've had a solo band. This is our fifth year. So I really wanted to have a CD of music that we could play live. So it was really important to concentrate on songwriting rather than instrumentals, which are sort of historically that's been my focus before.
Mm-hmm. Now, this album has 15 tracks, two of which are Tull covers, and the rest are relatively new. Of course, you cover some Howlin' Wolf in there and some Beatles. But the 15 tracks, how many are you including in the current live set that you're bringing back to Chicago?
We will play four or five, maybe six, including one of the Tull covers. But the nice thing is we can play all of the album. So we can drop one and put another one in whenever we want. At one time or another, we've played pretty well everything on that album.
Okay. Naturally, given your past 43 years with Jethro Tull, the fans want to hear you play those songs. And you always seem to give a fresh treatment to them, making them your own, separating them from the Tull catalog, per se. It seems like you really enjoy revisiting your past catalog as much as the fans love hearing you do it. What's it like to go back and try to recreate and put something, a new spin on something you've played for so many decades?
Yeah, well, of course, we didn't repeatedly play the tracks that I do over the latter decades. So things like Teacher, Cry Your Song, Minstrel, but they were rarely played, if not played at all, in the last 20, 25 years of Jethro Tull. So they're quite fresh to me, and they sound pretty rejuvenated. But that early period of Tull is my very favourite time of my musical career, because it was so exciting, particularly from 1969 we first came to the States. The first week we were in New York and we played at Fillmore East, and I think we flew up to Boston to play at the Tea Garden, and then we came to Detroit and then down to Chicago. And, you know, each of those towns was just like one of the wonders of the world, because, you know, I was an English kid, I was full of American music. I loved everything about America, and here here I was experiencing for the first time this amazing cultural difference, this incredible place that America is. And, you know, it was a very magical and a special time. And the band, Death Red Soul, moved together. We did everything as a band. We went out, we walked through the streets. It was such an experience of being together. And I think it's reflected in the music, and it was very tight. It was very new. It was exciting. I really loved that period of time.
Now, during that time, you guys were teamed up with just about anybody that was anybody. You played with Led Zeppelin, yep, and Pink Floyd, and of course, Jimi Hendrix. Of those many concerts, and I know the sound and the production wasn't to what it is today, but of those those years working with all those different artists, is there one or two experiences that really stand out for you from that period?
Yeah, or just so many. Playing with Hendrix was amazing. And just to meet him and realize what an amazingly nice person he was. And, you know, that for me, I was very nervous. All these people, that they were my heroes before I joined Death Row Cell. So suddenly I was sharing a stage with these people. So some of them were really nice. Others were a bit sort of offhand. But the people who were really nice, really sort of set in stone the way that I should behave and the way I wanted to behave. So, I mean, you know, we did gigs with Beef Up. We did, we played with the Grateful Dead. They played for 4 hours. It was an amazing concert. Zappa, Chicago, Jeff Beck, so many people. But and we did a tour of America where Jethro Tull, the top of the bill, second on the bill was Fleetwood Mac, third on the bill was Joe Cocker. And, I mean, that was a phenomenal lineup. And we toured. We did a whole tour of the state with that lineup. And, yeah, but it's Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green.
Right.
Just fabulous music. Fabulous.
Why were the blues so embraced by the British youth of the 1960s? What ignited that huge blues explosion that gave us Peter Green and Clapton and Mick Taylor and Kim Simmons and Rod Price and yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, I always think sometimes you don't know what you've got because it's right under your nose. And, you know, here in America, I don't think people in the mid-60s and the late-60s really understood the heritage that was theirs and that was so incredibly important to music. But in the UK, we were starved of music. We had nothing. We had no good bands. We had no rock stars. It was pretty well rubbish. So everything that came from America imported in a vinyl. And we get maybe one new vinyl a month. But we would just crave this music and soak it in. And try and digest it. So and that's why all the English early English bands, the Pink Floyds, Fleetwood Mac, John Mayall, Cream, Led Zeppelin, the music that they brought back to America was ingrained with all these blues roots because we'd had all the blues music coming to England and just loved it a bit.
Did you ever get a chance to personally see some of the blues artists? I know that Muddy went across and Big Joe Turner and a lot of those guys were playing there.
Yeah, but very few. I mean, I was always gigging and I was playing sax and flute with the sort of R&B bands. I mean, I got to see very little. But they had a thing called the Blues Train, which was sort of Freddie King, B.B. King, Albert King, Buddy Guy, Sonny Terry Brown, and McGee, you know, the list goes on. And they were all on this train, and they went down England, and they would pick a station to stop at. They'd all get on the platform and play, and it was a TV show, like an hour special. It was amazing. So we had that once a week, and it was fantastic. But English people were just hungry for inspiration. Because we had none. I think in America you have so much that maybe it was difficult to source out what was pertinent to rock and roll and what wasn't, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly Chicago-style blues and Chess Records had its impact on you young Brits of the era. And it seems like you still have a tasty addiction for Chess Records blues because you've given us a great treatment of Howlin' Wolf's Smokestack. And I'd like to play that for my listeners right now and then talk just a bit about your choice of choosing that. More with Martin Barr on the other side.
I wonder why she left me those 7 years ago. She took another man and broke my heart in two. Got tired of this drink, now she wants me back again. Smokestack, lightning, thunder on the line. Smokestack, lightning, coming down the line. Her smile is sweet and the heart is beating so fast. Feed that hungry horse and break your back to make that fire hot as hell. Thunder down the track. Smokestack, lightning, thunder on the line. Smokestack, lightning, coming down.
Back home to Chicagoland, recycling some great Howlin' Wolf there and adding a personal touch as well, my guest Martin Barr. And that is Smokestack off the Back to Steel album, his latest album on Garage Records. And Martin is our guest tonight. Martin, interesting choice of that song. Is there a reason that you chose that of all the great blues songs out there?
There's so many, you know. I used to play that pretty well when I was a schoolboy, and I took great liberties with it. I think there'll be some purists out there that will hate me.
I think that's what makes it unique. I love it.
Well, thank you. I added lyrics and I sort of, you know, changed the music a bit. But it's just a great riff, and I looked at it on YouTube, all the songs is just that riff. I just thought, that's just amazing. It's such a hypnotic piece of music. You know, the reason I did it is because I can. I'm released from the chains of playing Jethro Tull, you know, from beginning to end of every set.
Mm-hmm.
I love Tull. I love the heritage. I'm proud of what I did. And I carry the flag. But, you know, I want to have fun with it. And I want to play music that I really love. And I think there are no barriers. If you want to do a Beatles track, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it sounds good.
Right, right. It's interesting, on the other side of that song, we were talking about how, you know, sometimes you don't even appreciate what you've got right in front of you, and that song is a prime example. I remember when I was in school, back in the early 70s, I was rediscovering music, and I heard Smokestack Lightning for the first time as recorded by the Yardbirds and thought it was theirs.
Oh, right.
And it made me go back and look at, you know, our own roots here in Chicago. Yeah. I was like, 20 miles from where that song was originally done, and I had to go to England to get the Yardbirds version to inspire me. So,
yeah. Well, I saw Robert Plant play with his new band a couple of years ago, and they did an amazing version of Spoonful. And, you know, it sort of inspired me that you can use these fantastic, simple blues songs, and they are so great, but you can really embellish them and make them your own and stamp your own identity. And because of hearing Spoonful with Robert Plant, I did a version of Crossroads with the mandolin, which we play live. And it's different. I love it. It's great.
Now, we were talking about how the British musicians of the 60s were inspired by the blues, and I've got to wonder, what inspired you to pick up the guitar as a youth? Why music and why guitar?
Yeah. Well, I think it was an escape from the sort of humdrum school. You know, life in England in the mid-60s was really boring. It was just, and I didn't really get on. I wasn't part of the crowd. There was something in me, and I didn't know what it was, that was different. And I'm not special, I'm normal, but I just didn't fit the groove that you're supposed to when you're at school. You know, you go through all the channels, and you're sort of funneled into this system. And I didn't want to be that person. I got into a lot of trouble, I resisted it. And then my sister took me to see a band in probably 64, in Birmingham, England. And, you know, I was mesmerized. I can remember them to this day. And I just saw the guitar player, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. I mean, not as a career, but just what I wanted to do as a person. And I've always held that inspiration. I love music. I love the guitar. I love hearing other people play music. It's the most wonderful thing on the planet.
How long did it take you from seeing that band to actually going out, purchasing a guitar and trying it on your own?
Oh, about a week.
Okay.
About a week. But the guitar I bought cost about $5 from a junk shop, and it had a big split down the back. It wouldn't really call it a guitar, but it didn't matter. And it took me years to be able to play anything reasonable on it. I mean, it was a very slow process. So you had very small amounts of information, but you had the time to digest them. And I think, you know, I learned R&B over long periods, Tamla. Every genre of music came and went, and fashions came and went. But I had a long time to digest it. And I think rather than these days, kids want to learn to play, you know, in 6 months that they're out on the road playing.
Right.
They miss out a lot of the basics. And I think the blues is the foundation, the basics of all music.
Now, you've certainly come a long way since you bought that junkyard guitar, and these days you play Paul Reed Smith, it seems like, exclusively. Yeah. What is it about PRS guitars that you like so much?
Well, you know, the good people, I played them before I actually met them, and I just happened to call the factory. You know, I had a problem, and, you know, they were so pleased that I called them. I was on the phone for about 2 hours, and, you know, they're passionate about what they do, and that's the way I am. And, you know, all the gear I use, I use Soldano amps. I just deal with people who are really passionate and committed at what they do. So the guitars, they're great tools of the trade. And my best friend, Paul Hamer, lives in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And when he used to build guitars, it's the same thing. You know, he was such an incredibly passionate builder. You know, he put so much of himself into what he did. And I love that. You know, I can feed off that. So we've remained best friends ever since I met him.
And when did you start playing the Paul Reed Smith?
I've been playing them probably 15 years now.
Okay. Are there any amps in particular for the guitar players listening today? Any guitar amps in particular you like?
I use Soldano Decatones, and I've used Soldanos for about 25 years, and it's the same deal, you know, that they're a dedicated company in Seattle, that they have a great product. It's incredibly reliable. I fly around the world, they get thrown off planes, they bounce, they go through, you know, Arctic weather, through desert weather, and they just work, and they sound really great.
Wow. You take the full band with you on all the tours, right?
Yeah, they're really vital. You know, we've grown and learned what we're doing all together. It's a unit, and everybody has equal importance. It's not a solo band. I'm not a solo performer, and I give the guys a lot of space musically, and we're committed as a band for the long term.
And that is George on drums, Alan Thompson on bass, and vocalist Dan Crisp.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you were talking about giving them space on stage and giving them space to create. That is something that always seemed to be a problem within the ranks of Jethro Tull. It seemed like some of you guys were frustrated because Ian would have it so completely envisioned. Is that true, or is it just...
Yeah, it was. You know, it changed. In the early days, it stand up and benefit. We all had a lot to do. And I, you know, for reasons that I'm not interested in talking about, Ian just became more of a solo artist very slowly, but very, very solidly changed what he wanted from music. And in the latter days, he was almost unaware of who else was on stage with him. And that's, you know, I don't have an ego. I don't need to play lots of guitar solos and be at the front of the stage. I'm equally happy being part of a backing band, just part of a good band, whatever my role is. But when Jethro Tull finished, I only then did I realize how little guitar playing I was doing. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, I was released, and it was the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, it seemed like you guys were always wrestling with what was the lead instrument, the flute, the guitar. It's nice to hear you when you play the Jethro Tull songs now. There's a lot more going on with you as a player, and it's refreshing to hear. Like I said, your fingerprints are all over songs like Skating Away and even on an obscure song like Slow Marching Band. That's something that kind of surprised me that you revisited. That's off, I believe it was Broadsword and the Beast, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I just love that song. We never ever played it live, and I was just listening to it, and you know, I was thinking that that's such a great song. I want to have a go at it, and really, I haven't changed it except that the original was nearly all keyboards, piece of John Patesi, and fantastic playing. So I had to sort of learn all his nuances and really subtle things he was doing in that piece of music, and I translated them to mandolins, bouzoukis, guitars, and I just had so much fun with it that it was going to be a bonus track on the album. It doesn't really fit in with the rest of the style of the album, but I just had to have it on record because I just like it so much.
It's not one of the songs you would think that you would ever recover from or cover over again, but it certainly is a highlight of the album. Even it doesn't quite fit musically speaking. But for those old Jethro Tull fans out there listening, I think we need to share that with them because it's such a unique take. This is Slow Marching Band. We'll have Martin Barr with us on the other side one more time.
Join the slow marching band and take pleasure in your leaving as the ferry sails and tears are dried and the cows come home at evening. Could you get behind the slow marching band and join together in the passing of all we shared through yesterdays in sorrows everlasting. Take a hand and take a bow. You played for me, that's all for now. And never mind the words, just hum along. Marking time through winter, you paid the piper and called the tune, and you marched the band away. Take a hand and take a bow. You played for me, that's all for now. And never mind the words, just hum.
Marching Band, originally heard in 1982 on the Broadsword and the Beast album from Jethro Tull. That is a new version off the latest studio album from my guest Martin Barr, Back to Steel. And Martin is our guest this evening. You can catch him at Reggie's Rock Club, and they're going to be there this Friday. It's a 7:30 show. Reggie's is at 2109 South State Street. Keep up with Martin at martinbarr.com. And we've got a little time left to talk. Martin, of all the Jethro Tull songs that you have under your belt, you were on all but I think the first album. How do you decide what to cover? I mean, are there any in particular that you look forward to playing on stage when you choose to do one?
you know, I listen to all the catalogue, and I get so many suggestions from fans. You know, they say, "Oh, have you thought about doing it?" I mean, the exciting thing is that we can play anything, and you know, God bless Ian. You know, his voice is deteriorating; it's a real tragedy. But and that restricts what he can do. But with Dan, we can do any track we like, and it's an amazing ability. So I've got this huge catalogue to delve into, and I just, you know, try and find a couple of new things every tour. So this tour, we've got two brand new tracks, and they're not the normal ones. They're not predictable. Mm-hmm. Something a bit left of centre. So yeah, I like something quirky, something people go, "Wow, I can't believe they're playing that," and at the end of it, they really love it. It's nice. It's really nice. I take a lot of pleasure and a lot of pride in playing the Toll music. I mean, as I said earlier, it's me. I've dedicated 43 years of my life to playing with Jethro Tull, and I it's very, very important to everything about me. So I'm very proud to do it.
Now, in addition to that vast catalog of Tull songs, you've got a fair share of non-Tull albums to your credit, both solo with this band, and as well as the work you do with John Carter. Digging down into your playlist, your set list, your catalog, how many of those songs do you unearth from time to time?
Yeah, you know, I'm ashamed to say not many, and I guess I've taken second place. I mean, Back to Steel and Tull are the sort of prime sources of music, but then we love playing. There's some great tracks out there, and we play a Porcupine Tree song occasionally,
okay,
a Government Mule song occasionally, just because they're such great songs and there's so much fun to play, and I like the fact that we can do that if we want to. We're not a cover band. We're just playing music we love, and you know, we bring something to the table. It's not exactly the same as the original. It's still got the sort of Martin Barr band stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. I think because of all my solo material, but most of it was instrumental, and I'm happier playing songs because I like bands to be up there as a four piece. And we do one or two instrumentals. And we bring them back occasionally. So there's some things like Misère that are quite popular to play. And, there's a huge call of music, and we can't play it all. So we have that fantastic choice of finding it very difficult to know what not to play. It's a real luxury. You know, we've got a huge choice, and they're all good choices.
Do you ever think you'll be playing any solo acoustic instrumental tours at all to fill in gaps at all?
Yes. Funny you say that.
Okay.
We're doing an acoustic show in Connecticut in October, and that's a sort of precursor to next year. We're going to be on the road 6 months, spring and the fall, and we're going to mix electric shows with acoustic shows. And I did an acoustic show in the UK, a sort of, you know, two and a half hour show, just three musicians, me, Dan Crisp, and another guitar player. And it works so well. You know, we sort of do them in sort of really nice, sometimes a church, an art institute, an art gallery, or an art centre. So it's a very intimate setting, and so the audience are sort of very much part of the gig, and there's lots of chat, and we make it a really fun, relaxed evening. And of course, there's another load of music that comes under that banner of acoustic. So I've got material from an album that they called Away With Words.
And, excellent album.
Thank you. And it's very challenging because acoustically you don't get away with anything. You know, you can hear every note, every pin drop. There's a big challenge, but I like that. I like a challenge, and the guys, great musicians. So, yeah, we will be doing acoustic shows as well.
You mentioned Away With Words, and that was an interesting album because many of the tracks were like mini medleys of different things. Normally, you'd think these songs wouldn't work together, but you made them work beautifully.
Yeah, Well, it's sort of historically, me and Ian worked together. I wouldn't say writing songs, but arranging songs. So in songs like Budapest, I wrote part of the music, Minstrel in the Gallery. I mean, it's something we always did. I would write sometimes a piece of music that would fit into one of his songs. So it's not something that hasn't happened before. And, you know, that empathy, that sympathetic musicality between me and Ian is written in stone. We had 43 years of it, and whatever happens now or in the future, that musical relationship sort of there in my mind, in my body.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did contribute, obviously, a lot of input into the songs over those years, yet most of the time mm-hmm. it's credited to Ian solo. Yeah. I never understood that. When an artist, when a group performs and they write together as a unit, usually yeah. everybody gets credit. And you have credit on certain albums, but on a lot of them you yeah. don't.
Yeah, it's fine. I was never into the financial and that side of what I do. You know, if we make a good living, I'm very, very happy. And I never sort of look at all the sort of financial accounting side of music. It wasn't important. The important thing was that I was involved and I loved what I was doing. And more important, I was allowed to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very latter years, I wasn't allowed to be involved at all. So really, Death Row Tull, in my mind, ceased to be a band several years before it actually finished, just because of the attitude. And it wasn't a band where everybody sat down and wrote music and had input at all. So it had changed radically. But, you know, I'm happy with what happened. I don't have any problems with it at all.
Okay. Well, you've spoken very respectfully, I should say, of Ian and the band. And I know when I've had Ian on the show, he has done the same. He's done nothing but praised the band members over the years, and yourself in particular.
Yeah.
That said, do you think there's ever going to be a chance that you and Ian will work together as Jethro Tull?
I think it becomes less likely as the years go on. And now, I mean, we don't have any contact at all. I haven't had any contact in 5 years, and it was a divorce, and it was a very messy divorce, and I was quite hurt by the way it was done, but you know, I was very determined to recover from it and get back out on the road and play music, because essentially fans, and particularly in America, you know, our musical career is completely based around being in the United States. And I owe the fans of Death Row Tull and of myself a huge debt. And I intend to play as much as I can, as well as I can, for as long as I can, because I love doing it. And it means so much to me.
Jethro Tull's catalog is so rich and so diverse over the years, if you go from the first albums to the latter-day albums. And that said, what do you feel is Jethro Tull's most overlooked album or underappreciated album that you might say to a fan, if you haven't tried this one, give it a shot, throw it on the turntable?
Okay, yeah. Well, I think Benefits, one of the nicest for songs, but I think Under Wraps was a particularly overlooked, because it was unfortunately it was in an era where electronic music was very popular, so we were playing with drum machines and sequences and really essentially they're horrible things. we made a mistake going down that route, but the song and the playing on the album I think are really good, and we had Peter John Battesi in the band for Under Wraps. And he was an absolutely phenomenal musician. I mean, he taught me so much about music. He was a fantastic character as well. So I think probably that album might be, if it was re-recorded using a real drummer and no sequences and none of that sort of keyboard stuff. It would be a different beast, and it would be a really great album.
All right, so take it back to 84 and revisit that and see if you might just pay attention not to the drums but to the songs. That's your message there.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right. Yeah. Is there a particular album that is your personal favorite that you just can't get enough of that you think you guys hit your mark on?
Well, I love Benefit, and okay. I think it's where it came in Jethro Tull's career. We'd come to the States in 69. We'd recorded Stand Up, and I think maybe the second tour it was released over here. And of course, the first time we came to the States, people expected the music off This Was, which is more blues-based.
Right.
So that they didn't get what they expected. So they're quite bewildered by what they saw and heard. And it took a while for people to settle into what we were doing and to sort of tune in with us. But Stand Up came out, and of course it was so successful, and that was for me the time when I became accepted, because the first album was the blues Mick Abrahams, the second album was me throughout the whole album. Mm-hmm. But once I knew people accepted Stand Up, I felt they accepted me, and the whole band, we felt very much relieved that the direction we were going in was being understood and picked up on. So going into the studio and recording Benefit, we have such a positive attitude, a positive foundation to work on. And it was a really fun album to do. I really remember it so well as being a lot of fun, a lot of good songs, a lot of good playing and togetherness. I think it was the sort of pinnacle of my time with Jethro Tull.
Okay, now I know you guys were very focused on the music when you were making it and recording it, but I've heard The Crest of a Knave, which was 87, was an album that you spent extra time recording. What was it that made those sessions more time-consuming, more different? It certainly paid off. I mean, it's one of the best albums, in my opinion, of the catalog.
Yeah, I agree. But I think when you said which is my favorite album, I'm looking at albums that sort of went under the radar.
Right.
But Crest of a Knave is absolutely accepted as being a really important album. And basically, Crest of a Knave was Ian, myself, and Dave Pegg in the studio. All the drums were added later, so we were in there writing, arranging. It was really intense. I think we spent a couple of months, just working on the music, and we put so much into it that thankfully that reflects in what you hear on the album.
Mm-hmm.
And I had more space. Ian was amazing. He gave me so much space for my guitar playing, and So it's a really important album for me. And just the fact the three of us were, it was only a three-piece band.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot more room to maneuver, come up with ideas. And I think the problem with working with people like Eddie Jobson and Peter Battesi, that they were so quick in their musicality that, if Ian say, oh, we need an instrumental segue in this song, Peter would be like, got it. Within minutes, he would have it in his mind, and I'll still be going, oh, hang on a minute, hang on, I've got an idea. Too late. So with Crest of a Knave, I had the time. There was time to sort of sit and go in a room and write a piece of music and really work on everything really thoroughly. It was good for that as well.
One thing, last Jethro Tull related question, that is, whatever happened with Dave Pegg? I've not heard from or of him in a long time.
Oh, really? Oh, Dave is thriving. He's back with Fairport Convention and has been for many years. And Fairport don't play in the States, but they are an amazing band. Very folk roots, very traditional. They have incredible connection with the audience. they're phenomenally gifted players. Chris Leslie is a mandolin. He's a violinist who plays mainly mandolin now. Incredible players. Because I'm friends with all of them, I go and see them play a lot. That they play 2 month tours of England. They play in Europe. They play festivals. They have their festival Cropredy every year in England. And this year's their 50th anniversary. And I'm hoping that the Marcin Barr Band will be playing on that festival. But you know, Dave is an institution. I love him. He's my very, 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 very best friend and a wonderful person.
That he is. He's a great musician.
He's a great musician and the nicest person you would ever want to meet in your life.
Martin, we are just about out of time. I do want to squeeze in a final song and remind everyone that the Marcin Barr Band will be at Reggie's Rock Club in Chicago. That's this Friday, 7:30 p.m. Central Time, 2109 South State Street, where you'll find Reggie's, and Reggie's will have Marcin Barr performing. What would you like to play? Let's play something else off Back to Steel.
Let's go out on something manic and crazy, the opposite of Slow Marching Man, Moments of Madness.
Moments of Madness. We're going to get to that right now. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you visiting us not once but twice this year. And
Tom, it's always a pleasure. Let's do it again.
All right, we'll do that. This is Marcin Barr Band, Moments of Madness.
Unlocking doors to my dreams. Hypnotic voice and an evil that lurks beneath the sheets. I can't scream.
In the moments of madness. In the moments of madness. A glimpse of my insanity, awoken in my sleep. The seed is there, and I feel it grow in a pool of cold, cold sweat.